Okay, good evening, everybody. Our topic for tonight is the great wave of immigration. So Eastern European Jews make their way to the United States. And this class will cover 1881 till World War I. Some would extend it as far as 1920 or 1924. Depends how you want to define the chronological length of the great wave. But basically, it's 1881 through World War I. We'll spend many sessions on this time frame on other topics, not just the immigration process itself, but tonight we'll discuss the physical act of going from point A to point B, why people went and how they got there. So 1/6 of the 250,000 Jews who lived in America before 1881 were Eastern European extraction. But up until that time, the tendency was to Germanize. That just as the tendency among the earlier wave among German Jews was to become Sephardic, so in the second wave, the Easterners became German. You try to imitate the superior culture. So whereas in 1810 or 1820, the Yeki who comes to America tries to imitate the Spanish Portuguese because that's who the cultured Jews are. So too in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, the Polish Jew, the Russian Jew, who's an early arrival to America, tries to imitate his co-religionists who came from Germany and Austria. Okay, now it should be noted that there was some manifestation of truly Eastern European Judaism prior to 1881. As early as 1852, Beit Midrash HaGadol, the Norfolk Street Synagogue, was a Russian synagogue. And in 1872, there were 30 Eastern European synagogues in New York City alone. In 1865, among the Jews in California, the majority of the Jews were actually Eastern European, not Central European, not German. So there were pockets of the country where the Easterners dominated even before the Great Wave. But still, on the whole, the culture of American Judaism was the Deutsch, was a Yeki culture. What percentage of Jews world over were actually living in the United States? So in 1880, 3% of world Jewry was living in America. By 1920, it was 23%. So a dramatic increase in the raw percentage of world Jewry that lives in America. Why did people come to America? What was so terrible about Eastern Europe that led to this wave of immigration? Well, a series of things happened in Poland, in Russia, Romania, Lithuania, in the latter half of the 19th century that made it undesirable to be there. So first of all, in 1863, yet a Polish nationalist uprising, which really has nothing to do with the Jews. However, the crackdown by the Russians against the Poles led to an unpleasant environment in what was called Congress Poland, the area around Warsaw. And so, you know, some Jews actually participated in the Polish rebellion, thinking that that was their ticket to removing the Tsar's yoke from their neck. Moshe asked, what was the world Jewish population in 1881? We can't know for sure that year because there was no census that year, but there was a census taken in 1897, at which time there was about 7.5 million Jews in the world. Okay. So after that, in Lithuania, there was a very bad famine between 1867 and 1869, which led to an exodus of Jews from Lithuania throughout the 1870s. A significant percentage of them went to the United States. There was also a cholera epidemic in Poland in 1869, and then there was general poverty in the Galician hinterlands throughout the 1870s. But the big one, was the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881. The assassination was blamed on Jews. Jews were not really involved. There was a bunch of 12 anarchists, of whom one or two were of Jewish extraction. But it was not a Jewish assassination plot. It was an anarchist assassination plot. And this led to major pogroms all over the Pale of Settlement, known as the Sufot Banegev, the stirrings in the south, because it came from the southern part of the Pale and went northbound. It was followed by the May Laws of 1882, or the Temporary Laws of 1882, which expelled 500,000 Jews from their homes in the rural parts of the Pale and led to the urbanization of Russian Jewry and making destitute a whole lot of people. So it's a tough time. The pogroms stopped roughly around 1884, and then there were other reasons why people would leave in the years that would follow. Asher has a question in the chat. Instability was rife in the wake of 1848 uprisings in Paris. Social people couldn't free the serfs, possibly encouraging mobility for the Jews as well. So the freeing of the serfs was a big deal. The freeing of the serfs was supposed to be, you know, their ticket out of destitution and being effectively enslaved. The problem was that a lot of them then were indebted to Jewish moneylenders, who then that didn't endear the Jews to the Russian population. Okay, so when things are bad in Eastern Europe, what options do you have to make life better? Well, it's a big question. Where is the solution to your problem? One solution is, well, just leave. It's bad here, but the grass is always greener somewhere else. So where is that somewhere else? In large measure, it's the United States of America. So leave. But others said we have to focus our migration pattern on a specific spot on Earth, namely where we can have a national home. Now, that might be Zionism in the sense of Eretz Yisrael, but it also might not be Eretz Yisrael. It might be territorialism, wherever there could be created a Jewish political entity. And in years past, we've discussed Jewish territorialism. So moving is an important part of the solution, whether you're moving for ideological reasons to Palestine or for ideological reasons to some other national home, or just get out of there and go as a yachid, as an individual, to wherever it's most economically and politically comfortable. But there are other approaches, and that is to say, some people think you shouldn't move, but rather you should change the society in which you live. Mm-hmm. So this is the perspective of socialism, and the Jewish Bund will eventually adopt that point of view, that Deutschkeit, we do it here. We don't go anywhere. We don't take a boat ride somewhere. We stay where we are, and we make the world a better place. Tikkun Olam, where we live. And that's all well and good, but nothing really happens of any substance until the Russian Revolution of 1917. And then life doesn't get any better. It just, you have Soviet dictatorship, and life gets a lot worse. Or a different kind of bad, let's put it that way. Another perspective is, you stay here, but not that socialism is going to solve all the problems, but rather the liberalization of the politics of Russia will solve the problem. In other words, goodbye to the czar, to the autocratic czar, and hello to representative democracy. That was another point of view. Of course, it failed. I mean, ad hayom hazeh, until our very day, there really isn't a strong representative democracy in Russia. But there were people who thought that would be the solution. There were diaspora nationalists who say, we want to remain avowed Jews, whether or not by religion doesn't matter, but ethnic and national Jews who live as an ethnic minority in a modernized and democratized Russia. That's the viewpoint of Simon Dubnov, diaspora nationalism. And the last perspective, well, second to last perspective is old line orthodoxy. In other words, life stinks, but that's the way it is to be a Jew. Shveretz Zayin Yid. We're accustomed to life not being pleasant, and we'll just keep with our frumkeit and plow forward. But the last point of view is out and out assimilation. In other words, it's an autocratic system, and we're not socialists. We don't want to upset or overturn society. But we just don't like the fact that we suffer on account of our Jewish identity. So what do? We jettison our Jewish identity. Goodbye, Yiddishkeit. Hello, Goyishkeit. Not necessarily conversion to Christianity. Just, you know, we don't identify as Jews anymore. Okay. So those are the various ideological turns a person could take when times are tough for the Jews of Eastern Europe. So the perspective of the governing authorities in Russia throughout the 1880s was that whatever is expressly, whatever is not expressly prohibited is permitted to the Russian Gentile. And whatever is not expressly permitted to the Russian Jew is prohibited. So in other words, the err on the side of favoring liberalism for the Gentile and constricting rights for the Jew. In the educational realm, there was numerus clausus instituted in 1886. And as a result of that, in 1887, 23,000 Jews went to the United States. Many of them were students with no path to an education, because the universities or the gymnasia had been closed off to them on account of discriminatory laws. Okay. Well, Constantine Parnostov, who was a macher in the church and in the Russian hierarchy, famously said, regarding the Jews of Russia, that one third will die, one third will convert to the Orthodox Church, and one third will run away, and there'll be no more Jews in Russia. Did this come to pass? Well, obviously not. There remained Jews in Russia, but a significant chunk of the people ran away. A small percentage, a very small percentage, converted to Russian Orthodox Church. And a not insubstantial percentage died in the various pogroms or in the Russian Revolution. Okay. So the number of Jews running away to America increases dramatically in 1892. 107,000 Jews over that two-year span. But then there was a bit of a quiet time. Things cooled down between 1893 and 1898, and the numbers of those crossing the ocean were relatively small. But then, after 1898, the discriminatory laws were once again strictly enforced, and Russian anti-Semitism was blooming. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion were published and widely disseminated. So Tsar Nicholas II, who was our enemy, was ratcheting up the anti-Semitism, which in turn will likely increase the number of Jews who want to get out. The pogroms of 1881 to 1884 were not nearly as violent and lethal as the ones that would follow two decades later. Between 1903 and 1906, there were major pogroms in a significant number of Russian Pale cities, including Kishinev, which was the first really significant one, when 47 Jews died. But there was another one in Odessa where 800 Jews died. So whereas in the 1880s, the violence was surprising, but the loss of life was relatively minimal, now the loss of life is way over the top. If you compare that to World War I and the Holocaust, so it's almost nothing. But at the time, in 1903 and 1904, 5, 6, these numbers were shocking to the Western audience, whether the Western Jew or the Western Gentile. And so the impact of the Kishinev era pogroms on the psyche of the Westerners should not be discounted. Okay. What happened in the minds of the Russian Jews as a result of these pogroms of 03 to 06? So two things. Number one, many people lost their traditional orthodoxy. So people who had gone to school in the cheder and grew up pious from a yid, well, you know, seeing what they saw, it was hard for them to keep their faith. The other thing is a recognition that we're not going to improve our situation here in Russia. We got to get out of here. Got to get out of here. But where to go? That's the question, and we'll see soon what the options are. Now, two-thirds of all Jews stayed, however. They didn't leave. And throughout the Great Wave, the majority of Jews never left Russia. So why not? So one of the reasons is because some people, for ideological reasons, still held out hope that Russian society could be changed for the better, whether on the grounds of socialism or what have you. Others, for religious reasons, regarded America as the Tref of Medina. And you can't go. That even if materially your life would be better somewhere else, still it's verboten to go because you'll become a chazer fresser and you'll become a machalal Shabbos and all sorts of heretical things will happen to you if you go to the Tref of Medina. So these are some of the things on the minds of people who have to make a decision. Do we go or do we stay? Now, another factor is inertia, simple inertia. The easiest thing is always to do nothing. So do nothing means you live where you live and you don't go somewhere. Okay, now, Socialists held out hope through the 1905 Russian Revolution. But that revolution was crushed. And although there was temporarily a Duma, a parliament, it was done away with by the Tsar. So the failure of the earlier leftist revolution in Russia is what caused many socialist Jews to leave the country and go where? So some made aliyah to Israel. That's the second aliyah. That's the David Ben-Gurion, Yitzhak Ben-Zvi aliyah that led to the founding of the State of Israel, because those folks who came between 1904 and 1913 were the ones who founded the country. But it also meant that some really hardcore socialists and communists would come to the United States, including to the Lower East Side. And although there had been Jewish socialism in America before that time, it was really intensified as a result of the failed revolutions in Russia. Okay. Immigration was a personal choice. It's just that so many people made the same choice at right around the same time. And there was no turning back. This is what distinguishes the Jews from other ethnic groups. David Simrad asked, did the Kishinev pogrom have a profound effect in the U.S.? So the answer is, yes, it did. Insofar as, and I'll explain in about 20 minutes, the Jews in America who might have been not so in favor of massive Jewish immigration, in other words, the well-established, the wealthy German elite, who didn't want to see hordes of Orthodox and communist Jews coming from Poland to Russia, after they saw Kishinev, they realized, you know what, whatever objections I might have had, I have to put aside, because we don't want people to die and get killed in bloody riots. Okay, so the fact that the Jews are going across the ocean and are not coming back differs from, say, the Irish, the Italians, or some of the Slavic immigrants, that almost every other group had a substantial percentage of those who went for financial reasons, and they made their money, and then they returned home. And they did not stay indefinitely in the United States. Were there Jews who did that? Yes, there were some, but a very small, small number. Usually when you crossed the ocean, that was it. You were never going back. And if you did go back, it was only to retrieve your family. And even that typically didn't happen. Usually the family was sent passage and they had to go on their own. And the family member who was in the United States just waited for them at the docks. And, you know, they saw, oh, what happened to your beard? What happened to your payas? Well, it's been 3 years and I cut them off. That was a classic story. So there was very little ideological immigration to the United States. Very little. When I say ideological immigration, I mean where people as a group went with an idea in their heads about what life is going to be like when they get to America. So like Bilu was an ideological group that went to Eretz Yisrael in 1882. So Am Olam was a small group that went out west to Washington State to be farmers. There was also an attempt at Jewish farming in South Jersey, in Woodbine, New Jersey. But for the most part, Jews did not go with ideological baggage, with an idea of changing American society or having a Jewish collective. They just went as an individual, and whatever happened, happened. You know, they hope for the best in life. Okay. More so than any other ethnic group, Russian Jews moved as families, meaning you didn't just have a kid, a 17-year-old teenager, go alone and make it in the world, but rather whole families uprooted themselves from the Pale and went together on the boat across the ocean. Now, sometimes that proved financially impossible, and it would have to be in fits and starts over a span of a few years. But that was only because they couldn't afford to go together. Ideally, the family unit would stay together. Also, but still, there was plenty of young people who went alone. There was a push and a pull. The push was, Russia stinks. Life is terrible. Numerous klausus, pogroms, anti-Semitic laws. So it's the push out. The pull in was the liberty and freedom of the United States and economic opportunities. So since there was both, that was a way to hasten the immigration. Well, 30,000 Jews had come from Eastern Europe to the United States in the 1870s, prior to the 1870s, there had only been about 7,500 Jews from Eastern Europe in the United States. So we're a very small number in the earlier waves, you know, in the Sephardic wave and the so-called German wave, up until 1870, almost nothing. Then 1870 had 30,000, which is considered a lot, because the whole Jewish population in America was only 250,000. And then after 1881, the numbers skyrocket. Okay. Well, there was propaganda and literature, and sometimes propaganda and literature are one and the same, drawing people to America from the Pale. So famously, there was Anzia Yezierska, who wrote How I Found America. And one of the lines in her poem is, there is no czar in America, and everybody eats meat every day like a millionaire. Now, the fictional version of that, with Feivel Mouskowitz, an American tale, was, there are no cats in America, and the streets are filled with what?
With cheese.
There are no cats in America, and the streets are filled with cheese. If you didn't see American Tale after the class is over, YouTube American Tale, you'll like it. So, the steamship agents would propagandize about America, but people believed it because if they had family members who already were in the country, the family members would send back letters saying how wonderful this place is relative to Russia and that you would want to be here too. So where did people go? A total of 3 million Jews left Eastern Europe from 1881 to 1924. Western Europe took 7%. Palestine, Canada, Australia, Argentina, South Africa took together, combined, another 13%. The United States took 80%. So 4 out of every 5 Jews who left Russia went to America. And it made sense. America was the wide open country, the big frontier, big a lot of space. The Western European countries were already crowded. Palestine was a backwater. South Africa is the bottom of the world. Australia is the end of the world. You know, Argentina is not even in this world. So America is the destination. Well, how do you get to America? That's the big question. Border crossing. Border crossing was actually easier when done illegally through stealing across the border with Germany and then going to some large German city as a transit hub and then making your way to a port, whether Hamburg or one of the other German ports, and then getting on your boat to America. That was easier and less expensive than trying to leave through a Russian port. You could leave through a Russian port. However, in order to do that, you needed to have a Russian passport, which often cost a lot of money, sometimes $20. $20 was a lot of money. The steamship ticket itself was about $34 in 1903. So you didn't want to waste your rubles on paperwork, on passports that you didn't really have to have if you could do things illegally. But also, and even more dangerously, if you went to a Russian port and tried to leave the country on a Russian passport, and you were a man, and you were a man of draft age, then even if you were not technically subject to the military draft, conscription, they could just grab you. And what are you going to do about it? Nothing you can do. So it was best to avoid the Russian bureaucracy, if at all possible, and cross the border illegally. Well, after 1888, this became a lot easier because Russia stopped patrolling the border with Germany, and for that matter with Austria. So they couldn't care less who left, who came in. Maybe they cared, but as for emigres and stopping emigres, they no longer cared. With a wink and a nod, go, and we're not going to stop you. How did people afford the ticket? You know, $34 is a lot of money. So sell everything. Sell everything and buy a ticket. But could you trust the person who was selling you the ticket? That's a big question. So the shipping agents for the large shipping companies were basically reliable. They were reliable to handle the passage itself, the logistics of your luggage, train tickets to get to the port city, crossing of the frontier, you know, anything you needed to worry about to get to America, the major steamship companies had agents who could handle that for you. And for the most part, those people were reliable. However, other people who were like independent operators were often shysters and swindlers and would just take your money. You'd never see them again. take your luggage and never see it again. So people had to be careful who they interacted with on their way out of the country across the ocean. There were transit points in Central Europe that became hubs for a lot of refugees. So, for example, the town of Brody in Austria, like the Beis Medrash of Brody, there was a famous Beis Medrash. So Brody, because it was just across the frontier from the Pale, would sometimes house as many as 10 to 15,000 Jewish refugees. And those refugees actually outnumbered the real residents of the town. So that you could inundate a town with people stealing across the frontier. They needed help. Who's going to help them? Well, the Alliance will help them. The Maurice de Hirsch Fund will help them. There are certain philanthropic organizations that have a lot of cash to spend. They're going to have to spend it on feeding and giving some modest shelter to people on their way out of Russia across to another country. Okay. Well, Western European Jewish communities were concerned that these people who were moving west across the ocean should better keep moving and not stay in continental Europe, because if they stayed in continental Europe, they would overrun the existing Kihilot, meaning Central European Jewish communities were sizable, and they had some heft. There were thousands of Jews in Central and Western Europe, but nowhere near the number of Jews in Eastern Europe. Now, if there were 6 million Eastern European Jews, maybe there were at most 1 million Central and Western European Jews. And the Kehilot could not handle to feed and care for a tremendous number that outweighs them by a factor of 5 or 6. So it better be the case that these Russian Jews keep moving west, keep going. And where? Across the ocean, where you won't be our problem anymore. You'll be the Americans' problem. Good riddance. That was an attitude that existed in Europe. How long did it take to cross the ocean? So in the earlier part of the Great Wave, it took between 13 and 20 days, which is a long time. But the technology improved as the decades went on, so that by the early 1900s, it only took between 6 and 10 days, which is much more manageable. How did people afford passage? As I said, they have to sell their possessions. But even still, people had meager possessions. We're talking about poor people to begin with. So the answer is that they were able to afford it because the tickets were made cheaper by the creation of steerage. Steerage is a concept in shipping and the shipping of people that it might be familiar to us now, but actually was invented in the 1880s by a German Jew named Albert Ballin. How did he invent steerage? Very simple. America was shipping a lot of raw material back to continental Europe, especially lumber, timber. That occupies a lot of space. Well, when the ship is going from the harbors, the American shores, to continental Europe, then the hull of the ship, the downstairs is filled with stuff. But on the way back the other way, what was being sent? Luxury goods that are relatively small and don't occupy a lot of space, which means then that on the western half of the round trip, there's a lot of empty space in the bottom of the ship. What do you do with it? Well, you don't want to lose money by having empty space, so put a few beds in there. Instead of a few beds, put a few hundred beds in there, and lo and behold, steerage class comes to exist. And you could ship people away from the horrible life of Eastern Europe and get them to America. Okay. Well, the seasickness was terrible. The vomiting, the stories in the memoir literature, it's torture to read this kind of stuff. I, who get seasick and can't go on boats, I was getting nauseous just reading it. So people suffered terribly on their way to America. When they got to America, where did they go? So who knows, where'd they go?
Lower East Side.
Before they could get to the Lower East Side, where'd they have to go first?
Oh, Ellis Island.
So before there was Ellis Island, what was there?
Oh, Castle Garden.
Castle Gardens, right. Castle Garden. So Castle Clinton. Castle Clinton. Was a fortress that was built, I think, in 1807 and named for the former governor, Clinton. And that was the processing center from 1881 to 1891. The problem is it was woefully inadequate. I'm sure many of you have been there on trips to the Lower East Side. I think, Anshi Shalom folks, did we go there? Or Young Israel Woodmere guys, I think we went there a couple of years ago on our trip to Castle Clinton. I forget, one of our trips from one of the shuls, we went there. And you couldn't handle the massive influx of people. The sanitary conditions were just not sanitary. So the government had to do something about this. Well, prior to 1891, the federal government wasn't handling immigration processing. It was actually done by the state authorities in the state of New York, which is bizarre because New York is not a country. New York is just a state in the United States of America. And yet that's how it was. It was only after 1891 that the federal government took control of the whole thing in a setup on Ellis Island. But truth be told, even Ellis Island was insufficient. It was too small because you had some days where there were 5,000 people showing up. And Ellis Island, you know, can handle maybe 1,000 or 2,000, but not 5,000. So it was really a rough go of it. Well, when you got to the processing center, whether Castle Clinton or at Ellis Island, so what did they do to you? So they checked you for illnesses. And one of the things was trachoma, eye disease. Trachoma was seen as a Jewish disease, that Dafka, the Jews, got it. Now, not that the Goyim didn't get it, but the Jews were predominantly the ones who were getting it. And therefore, every Jew was suspect, and you had to check very carefully. Also, they checked for scalp conditions, for lice. They checked for dull-wittedness. Dull-wittedness is a fancy way of saying you're an idiot. If you were like a mental defect, they didn't want you. If you had contagious diseases, if you had loathsome diseases. I wonder, what's the difference in a contagious disease and a loathsome disease? I don't know. I wasn't there, so I couldn't tell you. But this was the concern. Now, what percentage of the people actually were rejected on the grounds that they were too sick? So the answer appears to be about 1% of the total, but oftentimes it was arbitrary and the result of capricious anti-Semitism on the part of the workers there who said, dirty Jew, let's send him back to Europe. Every family whose family members were processed through Ellis Island has stories about what happened. So in my family, and I'm not sure any of my family members are currently listening, maybe my mother or father is, but in my family, my mother's mother's mother, so my maternal great-grandmother, came in 1913 from Bialystok on the Russia with a lot of siblings. And one of the siblings, I think the younger brother, Harry, had an X marked on his coat that he had some kind of a physical problem, a health issue, and they didn't want to let him in. So his mother, what did she do? Smart mother. She took the coat, turned it inside out, and he wore it inside out, but the X was gone. Nobody saw it. He was let right through. So sometimes you had to do little stunts to get past the hostile administration at Ellis Island. The interview after the health checkup was over was also torturous. People got very nervous. They were scared. They would ask you, what's your name? Now, if the immigrant doesn't speak English, you need a translator. And yes, there were Yiddish translators and Russian translators and Polish translators. Translation wasn't really a problem. So the old story of Sean Ferguson is bogus story. You know, Sean Ferguson. Okay, so I already forgot the name that they gave me. Mm-hmm. May have happened, or maybe just a legend. The point is, there were translators. And Fiorello LaGuardia, as a young boy, you know, his father was Italian, his mother was Jewish. And he served as a translator on Ellis Island for a couple of years. He was a kid. So he told stories about these kind of things. Now, they would ask you, what's your name? You had to come up with a name. Did everybody come up with an alternative to their Yiddish name from Europe? No. Some just stuck with sort of an anglicization of the old name, which led to funny spellings, bizarre spellings of Hebrew and Yiddish names. Other times, people did take on a totally new name just because it was given to them by the immigration worker because it closely approximated what appeared on their Russian or Polish paperwork. So
I still remember this so vividly. 1956, the ship passed Ellis Island, passed the Statue of Liberty. It had closed already in 1954. So we actually went up the Hudson River, and the INS representatives came on board the USS Constitution of the American Export Lines to give us a final check. Lo and behold, I remember as a Bohor, I was always next to my father. Yeah. And he gained such stature that moment. The officer asked him, what is your name, Marathais? You are in America. You can be anything you want. My father, who never, periodically, even in Greece, would talk back to the authorities.
Yeah.
Said, and you, my dear friend, what is your name? And he proudly saw the tag, Misevinsky. And that's a typical American name. It's been in our family for generations. Amazing.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the story, the famous story for the Anshe Shalom folks, is Rabbi Weinberger. So Rabbi Weinberger, Rabbi Emeritus, he came later. He came in 1934. But it's a story that happened many times over in the Great Wave as well. So his name in Hebrew is Psachia Meir. So on the Polish passport, it had some kind of permutation of Psachia Meir, you know, with a J and an I and an E and a funny jumble of letters. But it started with a P for Psachia and an M for Meir. So at the gate at Ellis Island, father was asked, well, what's the boy's name? And they showed the paperwork. So the American worker didn't know how to pronounce that, how to spell that. He just wanted some close approximation. And there was a pack of cigarettes, Philip Morris cigarettes, on the counter. The father just pointed like this. So Psachia Meir became Philip Morris. That's how he got his name.
That's weird. Okay.
Now, who's helping these people get through the interview? So the answer is there's going to be some assistance from organizations created by American Jews to make sure that the new arrival is not harassed and is able to get through the processing unscathed. One of the big questions at the interview was, do you have a job ready? Now, someone did to say yes, thinking that was a good answer. But that's the wrong answer, because it was illegal to import labor. Everybody had to say, I have no job, that I'm going to look for a job once I get here. So who represented the immigrant aid societies had to instruct the new arrivals, don't foul up and say you have a job. Say you don't have a job, but you're going to go looking for one. One of the problems that had was the suspicion that they would be entrapped in white slavery and prostitution. That, you know, maybe not, that it was not intentional, but if they were all alone, then when they got off the dock, some guy in a fancy suit and hat was going to grab them and take them into a life of ill repute. So that created trouble for young women who came alone. One of the solutions to that was to have a family member who already was in the country validate this person, saying, they're my relative or they're my fiance and we're about to get married. And don't worry, this woman is not going to go off and do illegal things. Okay. Most people were only detained on Ellis Island, or for that matter, Castle Clinton, for a few hours. But some people were held for as much as 2 weeks because they required further interrogation. Why further interrogation? So sometimes there was a legitimate concern, but other times it was just because you had a nasty employee working there who wanted to find someone to harass. Now, the Hebrew Emigrant Aid Society, HEAS, Hebrew Emigrant Aid Society, HEAS, was founded by German-American Jews. So was the Hebrew Sheltering Society. And these gave guidance and early help to those who came off of Castle Clinton and Ellis Island. But these groups did not last very long. They kind of sputtered and petered out and they were gone. the one you know of, which still exists to this very day, is Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, not as opposed to Hebrew Emigrant Aid Society. Chaos was founded by Russian Jews, meaning people who had just been in the country for a few years, but wanted to help those who were coming after them. So it was founded in 1892. The initial impetus for the founding of Chaos was actually the need to bury Jews who died on Ellis Island. Every once in a while, someone made it all the way to America and then plots. You know, so Chaos had to take care of those people and find them a grave.
Well, in this atmosphere of suspicion about immigrants, I want you to know, and it should be put into everybody's mind, there was vetting, extreme vetting, as it was in our case, by the consulate in Greece that came to our hometown to investigate our background. Remember, this was still in the height of the Cold War. Right. They were concerned about whether we were leftists, whether we had communist sympathies. So you go through many hurdles before you get the visa to come to America. And it was, as you say, the Joint Distribution Committee that helped us and the Chaos to.
So Asher, what you're describing, it makes sense in the era when visas were required. Before they required a visa, so this sort of interrogation couldn't take place across the ocean because there were basically no American representatives across the ocean. Maybe there was a couple in St. Petersburg, but on the whole, all the person showed up in New York Harbor having never made contact previously with bureaucracy. So this is the first point of contact, and it usually didn't last very long. But if they thought you were a nefarious character, they wanted to talk to you a little bit further. Okay, now, German-American Jews did not like the great wave of immigration because they thought that the uncouthness of Russian Jews, of Ostjuden, was going to compromise the status of Jews in America. And Jews in America had already achieved a certain level of integration and social standing that would then, you know, crater if too many Jews showed up and were like super duper Orthodox with suspicions, or were leftist with their communism, or were just like repulsive in their personal habits. So this is a real concern. Now, some called for restricting immigration, for changing the law. So here you have Jews in America, German Jews in America, suggest U.S. Congress narrow the scope of lawful immigration so that other Jews can't get in. This was the case in the early 1880s. They said more Polish and less Polish. More Polish and less Polish. And also that the Jews of Eastern Europe were not yet ready for liberty. Not yet ready for liberty. So that's an expression that we found throughout the 20th century and even into the 21st century, that certain types of people, racial groups, ethnic groups are not yet ready for representative democracy. You know, they need a stewardship or a custodianship. This, you know, in recent history. Well, it wasn't a financial issue. It wasn't as though the German-American Jews thought they'd have to support impoverished Russian Jews who got to America. No, they understood that there would be eventually an element of upward social, upward economic mobility. So it wasn't a tzedakah issue. It really was more of a social issue and the insecurity that that German-American Jews felt about what they had achieved so far and how it might be undone by the arrival of people who were, you know, lower class, a lot lower. Also, it was a time of increasing anti-Semitism and accusations of moneylenders in the temple. The populist anti-Semitism of Ignatius Donnelly, and people wanted to find a scapegoat for the decline of rural America and the rise of modern capitalism. The economic collapse of 1893-1894 resulted in high unemployment, and in the following presidential election of 1896, you have William Jennings Bryan making his famous Cross of Gold speech, a diatribe against the gold standard, but that had overtones and undertones. So By early 1891, the German-American Jews actually turned the corner. And they realized we ought not to advocate for restricted immigration, but rather we have to advocate for unrestricted, unfettered immigration, because we can't be seen as doing the dirty work of our own enemies. And the anti-Semites don't want Jews here. And we, as Jews, you know, we might look down on our Eastern cousins, but we can't be as nasty as the Jew haters themselves. We have to protect the Jewish rights in America. Mm-hmm. The ultimate Jewish right is to arrive in America and let the Russians come in. So that became the change of attitude among the elite of the community. The pogroms of 1903 to 1906 made this even more true. In other words, once dozens and hundreds of Jews are getting slaughtered by the vicious cutthroats of the Cossacks and the Russian nationalists, you know, the elite Jews of America have to say, let them in, you know, let my people in, otherwise they'll die. In the 1880s and 1890s, there was radical change happening in the United States. And society was led to more than a healthy dose of nativism. There was a question in the chat: when the Germans first emigrated, did the Sephardim hold them in disdain? The answer is yes, they did. Until such time as the Germans got rich enough to hold the Sephardim in disdain. Because of nativism, there was a desire to close the borders, and Immigration Restriction League was founded in 1894. Madison Grant, some of you may have heard of, Madison Grant was the leading figure in racialism, or basically racism, in the United States at that time, and called for preventing the mongrelization of the races. And how do you prevent them? By preventing undesirables from entering the country. So you restrict immigration to those racial or ethnic groups that are considered desirable. In other words, Northern and Western Europeaners, and not Southern and Eastern Europeaners. So no Italian jobs, no dirty Jews, like that sort of thing. That was the attitude of Madison restrictionists. So what are some of the arguments that they would put forward against Jewish immigration to the United States? So one is disloyalty. But disloyalty here has nothing to do with like Zionism and dual loyalty and kibbutz galiot and Shivat Zion. That's for another time. We've spoken about that in the past at length. We'll talk about it again soon enough. No, this is not about Zionism. Mm-hmm. Just that disloyal in the sense Jews move a lot. The wandering Jew stay in any one place for a very long time. You have no real attachment and patriotic sentiment towards where you are. So if the Jew is moving from Russia to Poland to Lithuania to Western Europe, Central Europe, and he shows up in America, who's going to be loyal to America then? Also, that the Jew is weak-muscled, that the Jew is not a starker, the Jew is a pushover, he's weak-muscled, he's sensitive to pain, and shuns bodily activity. No, the Jews didn't go to the gym, to Equinox and Planet Fitness in 1894. These were some of the reasons why the restrictionists said we got to close the border. The government did, at the margins, tinker with the law. And so the LPC clause, which we'll talk about at great length during when we discuss the 1930s and the Roosevelt administration, the likely charge, which is how an anti-Semitic State Department kept out Jews during the Nazi era. So the likely public charge clause was already on the books by the 1890s. And it was very vague. And because it was vague, if you had a bureaucrat who wanted to exclude someone, they very easily could find some kind of petty justification to say, well, we don't know you're going to be able to support yourself. You're of limited financial means and you have no marketable skill. So you're going to be one of the Luftmenschen. Therefore, we don't want you. This was a real issue, the LPC, even early on. But on the whole, Jews were able to get past it. Because of an assumption, at least when the economy was moving, that you'd find employment and you'd be able to feed your family. Okay, so repeatedly in the late 1890s and early 1900s, bills were introduced into Congress to restrict the flow of immigration, but they were usually defeated. But the tide was turning in favor of restrictions. So the question was, what about a fear of socialism? Absolutely. So the fear of socialism is what will motivate severe restrictions in 1917, 21, and 24. The Johnson-Reed Act after World War I was in large measure racism, but also a fear of the Red Scare, that Jews are disproportionately socialist, and therefore their politics is a reason to keep them out. So Moshe is asking, what percentage of total immigration was Jewish during the time period? So the answer, I have a chart actually that tells us the exact answer to that. 1 second, let me look it up. I'll rattle it off. Starting from 1881 to 84, the percentage of immigration to the United States, general and Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe to the United States. So the percentage that was Jewish in 1881, 3%, 1885, 5%, 1886, 9%, 1887, 6%. The high point is 1891, 12%, 1896%, 1900, 13.5%, 1906, the big one, 14%. So 14% of total immigration was Jewish that year. Okay, so a little background noise and we mute everybody. So what happened was the tide was turning in favor of restrictions. A literacy clause was enacted in 1913 by Congress, but President Taft, during the lame duck session, vetoed it. In 1915, President Wilson vetoed the literacy clause. In 1917, the literacy clause was passed by law, and the president tried to veto it and was overridden. It was an override of the veto. That's now, what do you see from here? You see from here that the presidency was typically not in the hands of someone looking to restrict Jewish immigration, but the Congress was, that the Congress was the Jews' worst enemy, not the White House. Even though, you know, Wilson was certainly a bigot and a racist, but when it came to Jews, he wasn't so bad. You know, with vis-a-vis blacks, he was terrible. But, he was not the enemy of the Jews. And he appointed Brandeis to the Supreme Court and so on and so forth. So the literacy clause would have been a big problem. But the literacy clause was in your own language. So are Jews more or less literate than your average Italian or your average Russian Slav?
More literate.
More. But what's the problem? The problem is Yiddish isn't a real language. Did I just confess anybody? So
yeah.
Okay, so Yiddish is a fake language. Yiddish is a jargon. It's a bastardization of Middle High German plus a bunch of Hebrew words plus a bunch of Slavic words. So would Yiddish qualify as a language for literacy test purposes for immigration? And the answer is, well, Jew haters would get their way, it would not qualify. But if the Jews are able to lobby the administration, then it will qualify. So what happens? The big heavy hitters, we're talking about Jacob Schiff, Max Kohler, Felix Warburg, Cyrus Sulzberger, Simon Wolf, Louis Marshall, especially Louis Marshall, the lawyer, they all lobby the government to allow Yiddish to be considered a kosher language for the purposes of literacy test and immigration, and they won the day. Okay. Now, the next little subtopic in this is Americanization and dispersal. Dispersal. What does dispersal mean?
Like spread out over the country?
Good. It means not everybody's going to be packed into the Lower East Side, that you don't have 10,000 people on Ludlow Street, but you send a few packing, to points west of the Hudson. Well, the idea was, if the goyim who don't like us are afraid that, take over the country, or that we're going to be overrepresented in a certain district and ruin that area, we're going to ruin New York, we're going to ruin Boston, we're going to ruin Philadelphia, we're going to ruin Baltimore. So what do? We leave some Jews on the East Coast in the big cities, but we take other Jews and we throw them into the Midwest or the mountains, the far West. And that way, it'll be less of a problem. Dispersal. So the Industrial Removal Office was established in 1901 for this purpose, and it had very poor results. Why? Because Jews wanted to stay in the big cities. They wanted their Yiddish language compatriots, their landsmen. They wanted the landsmanschaft. They wanted kosher food, some of them. They wanted a shul. They wanted camaraderie, which you're going to get in the big cities in the ethnic Jewish neighborhoods, but you're not going to get that in Oklahoma. You're not going to get East Texas or West Texas, even worse. So people who were sent places on the Industrial Removal Office very often didn't stay where they were supposed to go. They ended up back in the Bronx 4 weeks later. And in my family, we have a case of that. So I'm not exactly sure which relative it was. My father could clarify which one it was, but through the Galveston Project. So people went to Galveston, Texas, and they were supposed to go from Galveston, Texas, to points in the Central Time Zone and Mountain Time Zone. But a lot of them just ended up back in New York very quickly thereafter, even though their passage had been paid for on the premise that they were not going to go to a big city. Okay, so that was the infamous Galveston plan. The Jews went to Galveston, Texas. Okay,
what was the love affair with the cigarette? Why were there early Jews involved in hen making cigarettes in the Upper West Side? I think it was, or something.
You're right that in New York, in particular, Jews were overrepresented in the tobacco. I don't really know why. I guess it was a way to make money. I mean, it was a profitable venture.
The language. It was simple. You didn't have to speak the language.
Yeah,
I guess so.
That makes sense.
Okay, so
but there have been a also in the background a plan for forced assimilation by driving Jews into different areas of the country.
So the goal was assimilation. I don't think it was forced assimilation insofar as those Jews who participated in the Industrial Removal Office or the Galveston Plan did so voluntarily. Now, they might not have understood when they signed up for it back in Russia what they were really getting into, but they did sign up for it. And it's not as though they were held hostage in, you know, godforsaken parts of the United States. Once they got here, they basically could go wherever they wanted. It's just they had kind of a commitment to go here, not there. Okay, now an idea of Jewish collectivism and farming was something that people thought might be a good idea, that get Jews back to the land. After all, you know, America does have a lot of farmland, but it didn't work itself out that way because Jews did not have a history of farming back in Eastern Europe. You know, they were own land. They were, you know, middlemen and brokers and engaged in other occupations, not in tilling the soil. So in the United States, it was really a foreign occupation. And despite the desire upon certain ideologues to do this, there was no way it was going to be successful.
The Jews in Europe were urban dwellers.
They were becoming more and more urbanized before they got to America, and they stayed that way, having gotten to America. The last point for tonight before we stop is that there was a certain ill will exhibited by the new arrivals toward German American Jewish sponsors and philanthropic supporters. They were known as the Yahudim, the German Jews, the Yahudim. They were condescending towards the recent arrivals. There was a little gap between the social standing of one group and the other. There was uptown and downtown, literally uptown and downtown, in the sense of in New York, at least, the uptown, midtown and Yorkville. Discussed the history of Yorkville / the Upper East Side as a haven for wealthier prior arrivals, meaning Germans, as the Lower East Side and downtown becomes Russified with the Orthodox and the Socialists, so that German Jews want to get out of there and hightail it to 70th Street and 80th Street and 90th Street. So you have this schism between the various groups. It was in the social realm, but it was also in the realm of religion and in political ideology. So the socialists and the capitalists are going to be at loggerheads. the old line Orthodox and the reformers slash atheists are going to be at loggerheads, and the wealthy versus the poor. So in many ways, the community was differentiating itself between these various camps. The overarching commonality was a desire to assimilate, number one, and to prevent Gentile anti-Semitism from interfering with Jewish integration in America. That it shouldn't be the case that an internal Jewish divide compromised the ability of the Jewish community as a whole to push back against the worst excesses of the anti-Semites. And in that regard, the Jews were largely successful, except for the of immigration restrictions after World War I. So we'll stop.
What might our ancestors think of what occurred today? Three prominent Jews selected to the cabinet.
Well, I'm sure they would like it. they'd get a whole lot of nachas. A lot of nachas. Okay, folks, see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.